Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hey, it's Max. We got a bonus episode for you, a special Father's Day edition of the Long Form Podcast. Last week, I was in Washington, D.C., and I stopped by Evan Thomas's house. Evan Thomas was a longtime writer for Newsweek. Before that, he was at Time Magazine. He's a National Magazine Award winner. He's the author of several award-winning books. He's also the father of Louisa Thomas. Louisa was an editor at Grantland. She also wrote about tennis and the NFL while she was there. She's the author of a new book called Louisa. It is not about her. It is about Louisa Catherine Adams, the wife of John Quincy Adams. It's fantastic. It's been getting rave reviews. You should check it out. But we didn't talk about the book very much. And what we did talk about was their relationship and following in your dad's footsteps and whether they show each other their work and how the industry has changed over their respective eras. It was a really fun conversation. They were really generous with their time. They were also generous with their food. I got a sandwich out of the deal. So it was fun. And we thought we would run it right now before Father's Day, a little special episode for you. I also want to quickly thank our friends at MailChimp and remind you again about their pop-up store. It's Freddy and Co. It's a really awesome idea. It's not for profit. They're featuring one product at a time from someone in the MailChimp community. They're even going to be running a little sale from Tuesday, June 28th to Monday, July 4th. You'll get free standard shipping on any order. And also, get this, a limited edition Freddy & Co. sticker. MailChimp is always doing great projects. This is another one. You should check them out. It's a way of supporting makers and it's a way of supporting us. But for now, here's my conversation with Louisa Thomas and her dad, Evan. Hi, Louisa.
Hi.
Hi, Evan.
Hi.
Welcome the Thomases in your own house. It's weird to welcome you to something when we're sitting in your house, but welcome to the show. This is a first time experiment for the Long Form Podcast. We have never, definitely never had family members on together before. You are both very accomplished writers in your own right, and I'm interested, and I feel like we should start with young Louisa and whether your dad's work when you were a kid was like a formidable presence in your life.
Not very, to be honest. There was always a little bit of a friendly competition between my parents over, I think that my mom kind of felt that I was more interested in my dad's work than telecommunications law, which is what my mom did. But I didn't really read a lot of my dad's writing growing up or watch him when he was on TV.
Did you read any of it?
I read a few pieces. I read a couple of your books.
I think she's lying.
I've read at least one of your books.
That was like
I never observed a child reading anything I ever wrote.
I mean, like,
I'm trying to think of anything I read of yours before the age of 20.
It's okay.
I'm not sure it is okay. Wait, so you were you not like intrigued? Was it just like that's what dad did and it didn't really
kind of that.
Were you like reading other journalism?
Yeah, I wasn't a big magazine reader growing up. I mean, I read Sports Illustrated. I read, you know, the New York Times in the morning. It wasn't that I read books. Like I was a huge book reader.
Just not your dad's books.
Just not my dad's books.
Well, I don't think Walk Up to the Iraq War is a great reading for a 13-year-old girl.
You know, I think that there was no, I think it's interesting to actually listen to long form podcasts sometimes, and a lot of writers talk about how they had a really strong sense of vocation. You know, they always knew they wanted to be a writer. They wrote short stories all the time. You know, they had some sort of passion, and there was a real sense of like calling. And I never had that. And I think partly it was because my dad was a writer. And so it wasn't, I mean, certainly in some families that would make it special, but in my family, it made it a job. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, one thing that I always appreciated and still appreciate is that writing to some degree is, if it's your job, then it's your job. And that can be really helpful. It means that sometimes when you have a deadline and something's not perfect, you know, you're not chasing perfection. You have something due. You have a certain responsibility. You're getting paid for this. And you have to hand it in, even if it's not, you know, you can't be precious about it. But at the same time, I think actually pretty early on, I even felt some sort of sense of fraudulence because I was like, well, what does it mean that when I was 12 years old, I didn't know I wanted to be a writer?
I always wonder about that, like when you go into the sort of family business, whether you go into the family business because you've been around it and you sort of picked it up and learned it, or whether it's just like the thing that seems possible. Like other jobs seem completely impossible, but that's like something you've seen.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of, I mean, I think for a long time, you know, like it seemed more plausible that I was going to go into the other family business, which was I was going to go to law school.
That is also,
we were hoping for that.
It was actually really funny. I mean, I think probably dad was hoping for it most of all, you know, as he was law school
on me. Did you not want her to be a journalist? Did you think she would be?
I sort of wanted her to be a lawyer, you know, the pay is better and it's secure. And she's a super smart student. So I thought she'd be a great, in fact, I'm quite sure it's not too late, Louisa. She's so smart that I went to law school. I've been around, my wife, Elsie's a lawyer. I know what smart lawyers are. Louisa would be a smart lawyer. I had no doubt that that was going to work out. But she didn't want to be a lawyer, so fine.
But you still wouldn't mind if she ended up going to law school?
No, I think it's probably too late.
There were a couple of moments, actually, though, even in my 20s when I was already embarked on the writing world where dad raised the issue of false. I distinctly remember I was a fact checker at The New Yorker, and then I became the editor's assistant, David Remick's assistant. And I was talking on the phone with dad about, you know, thinking through this decision, whether or not this was a transition I want to make. And he goes, well, it seems like you're deciding between this and law school. I was like, wait a second.
Where'd you get that from?
Yeah.
There was a very consistent fight for a long time between my brother and my dad. My brother's like, works in TV, super successful. He's a very fancy title, which I will not say because it'll embarrass him. But up until like a year ago, my dad was still, every time they saw each other, like bringing up business school. And my brother would be like, many, many, many people work for me with business school degrees. Like, I don't need to do that.
It was sort of funny because my mom, you know, when I was graduating from college, I briefly thought about, you know, going to like Iowa summer poetry writing workshop. You know, I've been accepted and everything. And my mom sort of wanted me to be a poet. My dad wanted me to go to law school.
Well, you would have been, you're a good poet. I mean, that was an early thing. She loved words. I could see that. I knew that from the beginning. I didn't know she wanted to be a writer, but she sure loved words and was able to string them together in ways that were pretty amazing. It took a while. You don't really know you're going to be a writer until you are one. And by the time she really became a writer, I could see it. I mean, I wasn't talking about law school. Once she was actually writing for publications, I went, oh, I get it. This is going to work.
You knew pretty early, though, right? I mean, you were writing for the Crimson.
That's a tortured tale because my dad was a book editor and he looked down on sports writers. And my father would say, well, James Reston started as a sports writer. Your listeners don't even know who James Reston was. He was, you know, a great columnist for the New York Times and was God to my father. The lead columnist for the New York Times, James Reston, he was Jesus Christ. And my father thought that's what being a journalist was writing columns for the New York Times. You didn't get there by being a sports writer covering the hockey team for the Harvard Crimson. So he would sort of go, oh, well, you know, James Reston started as a sports writer. And I sort of felt put down by all that. And so I kind of backed into it through sports.
Mm-hmm. I want to just go back to something you were just saying about your dad and your dad pushing you. Like, I can understand why you want your kid to go to law school because it's safe and secure. But when Luisa was making the choice to become a journalist, or maybe it wasn't even a choice, it just kind of happened, like an industry that you had been working in for a long time was changing very rapidly.
Sure.
Pretty clearly for the worse.
Well, the money was going away. I've learned from listening to your podcast, the industry is actually getting better.
Really?
Yes, I mean that.
How would you describe it? What do you mean?
Talent. Luisa got me to listen to your podcast a year or so ago by saying, I was whining about Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I thought contributes a little bit to victimization, which is I don't love. And so Luisa said, oh, come on, Dad. Listen to Ta-Nehisi Coates on this podcast called Long Form. So I did, and I was impressed by him. He was really interesting, and I get it. And so I listened to another episode, and then another, and then another. And it was young people who were incredibly impressive. And I'm thinking, not only are they impressive, they're really better than what I remember from my cohort at Time and Newsweek and when I was in my late 20s. What do I mean by that? But the more adventurous, more ambitious, taking on bigger stories, kind of more worldly in a way. We were in narrow slots. You know, when I was 30 years old, I'm writing milestones in PubLetter for these very narrow features because it's very hierarchical, right? Mm-hmm. And we're sort of slowly working up the hierarchy. Now there is no hierarchy. It's been blown up. People can sort of start at the top. They can jump into some magazine I never heard of before and write, you know, the history of the Peloponnesian Wars before they're 30 years old. And so it's very ambitious. And people are actually doing it because they love journalism and they love what they do and they love to write. And it's infectious and it shows. And so I think we're in a great age of letters right now. I really do, both in books and magazines. The product is better than it was in the so-called golden age. Now, there's less money, and one reason why I wanted my daughter to be a lawyer is because there's less money. So that, as a parent, that makes me insecure. But the product, I think, is better.
Did you ever give her a hard time the way your dad gave you a hard time?
I hope not. God, I hope I was a better father than my father was to me.
I think he was.
Let's just talk a little bit more about that and sort of like early Newsweek days. I mean, as you've watched sort of Luisa come up and end up at Grantland and writing these books, which are sort of similar in scope to stuff that you write, even though you haven't read the books, Luisa. they're sort of thematically similar.
I've been told.
I mean, one thing that's interesting about what you're saying about the young people you've heard on the show and just generally where the journalism stuff is at, it does feel to me like the sort of business model has kind of fallen away, and this idea that like you could show up in the, you know, mail room or as an intern or some very low rung at Time or Newsweek and know that if you did decently, there was a career for you there. There was a long-term path. That, I think, almost doesn't exist anymore. There's very few places that you can solidly expect are going to be around for a long time.
I was sad about that, but as I listened to your show, I'm not so sad about it because I think, I mean, it's scary and insecure. It's a little bit like medicine. Now that doctors don't make so much, you actually have to want to be a doctor. You know, you got to do it to be a doctor, not just to make money. Journalism, you got to do it because you like to write and you like to report and you're excited about it, not because there's financial security or even much prestige. I guess there's some prestige, but it's just, it's a different game. You know, I went into news magazines and that was great, but that was sort of where you went. If you were some smart kid who graduated from an Ivy League college, you probably wanted to work for Time or Newsweek or the New York Times or one of those places, and that was great, but it was confining. When you were young, you were doing scut work. Now, maybe it was polished scut work, edited by great editors, but it was kind of dumb. And that's not the right word. It was limited. Mm-hmm. And you gradually worked yourself up to writing more ambitious stuff, but it took a while.
Was it safe? Like,
it felt scary at the time because every organization makes whatever they're doing scary. Mm-hmm. So there was the internal pressures were great. And we were all competitive and trying to stab each other in the back and worried about what our bosses thought. So it felt scary, but it was safe in the sense that writing a 70-line story about what Congress did last week is pretty unambitious. Mm-hmm. I did that for a long time before I wrote anything that my daughter would even want to read.
Maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't. Did you Were you getting paid all right?
Yes. I mean, the pay was pretty good. Journalism pay. I spent a lot of time in my life chasing the starting salary at Cravath. I remember that. You know, my salary was always a few bucks behind whatever the starting lawyers were getting in Wall Street. But that was a pretty decent salary. And there were benefits, 6 weeks of vacation. Can you imagine that? 6 weeks of vacation at Time. Because Time was overstaffed. I think there were 500 editorial employees.
Good Lord.
Crazy. And it was so redundant, and it really was overstaffed. And that was stultifying. To be so overstaffed, that was stultifying.
It's funny, when I was at Grantland, you know, it was sometimes felt like a pretty shoestring operation. We got a lot of heat from Deadspin from having a huge staff, but it really felt like a couple people were kind of doing this. And we were producing like 40,000 words a day or something. And Dad looked at the masthead and just laughed, you know?
They produced every day what we produced in a week with a staff that was about 1/20th the size.
I feel like part of the thing that you guys got heat for at Grantland was not necessarily that the staff was so huge, but that the staff was very well paid.
That's true. I mean,
people didn't have sympathy for the like underdog.
I have to say though, you know, I mean, it shows the changing economies. My mom did not think I was very well paid. you know, I think that even that level had fallen, you know,
it was well below what a Cravath lawyer makes.
Yeah, exactly. It was not even the idea of chasing a starting salary at Cravath is like not even in the conversation.
The Cravath line.
Yeah.
like the Mendoza line. Yeah. But except you never go over it.
But yeah, we were, I mean, it wasn't just the pay, I think, that we got heat for. I mean, I got to go to Wimbledon, you know, I mean, there was a kind of, we got to chase the stories we wanted, and we had a big travel budget. I think that was something that I already remember fondly. It was nice. That was a positive thing. I thought that was a force for good. I never could really understand why we got heat for that. I was like, aren't you glad that, you know, this is like a counterbalancing, you know?
I think that's pretty human nature.
It's
not like the people who are giving you heat were also getting paid well. There's a pretty direct line there, I think. Do you guys talk about your work together?
Yeah, I love it. I love talking shop with my daughter. You know, mechanics, you know, where does the lead go? What's the nut graph? I don't know if that's the lingo she would use, but I use old news magazine lingo, of course. But we definitely talk about structure and word choice and interviewing and being anxious about an interview and how do you deal with it when your person doesn't want to talk to you. And we talk shop all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that has been the biggest. I mean, I think growing up, my dad being a writer didn't really play a lot into my life. But now it's great. I have this resource, you know. And I don't really use it differently than I think when he was at Newsweek. A lot of young reporters use my dad this way. Call him up, you know, talk through a story or, you know, how do you launder information, as I would put it. Like, you know, how do you think? Things like that, I actually kind of wish I'd gone to journalism school sometimes, because it took me a long time to figure out how to send an email to a source, you know, to ask to talk to them. That's actually kind of a hard thing to do. And no one teaches you how to do it. I still don't know how to do it.
Yeah,
and I have like a...
While you were saying that, I was like, I actually don't know how to do that.
I don't know how to do it either. I'm not sure
I know how to do it. I don't know why we picked that example.
Or you know, what happens when you're having a conversation and it's sort of moving in and out of being kind of on background, you know, or off the record? You know, how do you deal with information that you get and you're not totally sure that the source meant for this to be fair game, mm-hmm. you know? Like what, you know, interesting questions about ethics, but also just practical questions like...
Well, you were doing a story recently and you called up and said, what do I make of this? And I said, the person's bullying you. That's what's happening here.
Yeah.
And because I'd been bullied. So I was able to, and you know, oh yeah, I get it.
How does that manifest itself, like source bullying?
Oh, just kind of giving you a hard time about the questions you're asking reasonable questions and they're suddenly like turning on you and talking about how much they've helped you and you're betraying them somehow, and I'm like, what's going on? you want to say like, I'm on your side. You're not supposed to be on anyone's side, you know, but like, I'm sort of susceptible to that too. So, you know, and so in that case, yeah, to call Dad and be like, I don't know what just happened, and for him to say, this is what's happening. And also like, you know what? Like, just call them back and be honest.
Yeah.
Which is what I did. And I think hopefully it, for certainly from my side of things, like, things are above board, you know, like that it could only help. And hopefully it actually kind of helped diffuse things. So, you know, I think that that was an example in which I felt really lucky to have someone to call and be like.
Was there anything tricky about like following in the family profession? Like, did you pull strings or just decide not to pull strings? Not that like Louisa needed strings pulled, but, you know.
I helped get her a summer job at the Washington Post in the sports section when she was 16 years old as a clerk. You know, I called the sports editor. It was pretty direct. I called this Jared Solomon and said, would you please hire my daughter, the high school junior? Although maybe you'd heard about this job in advance.
No, I can't remember. You brought me in to meet him because I read this Washington Post sports section every morning religiously. Yeah. And you just brought me in to meet him.
That, I totally fixed her job as a clerk at 16. But after that, no.
That's not totally fair. I think that I definitely have gotten... I think that it helped being hired at the New Yorker that, you know, Dorothy Wickenden knew who my dad was.
Yes, of course, that's true. Dorothy Wickenden had been my editor at Time, so she knew my name, and, you know, we were... You know, friends. I feel friendly towards Dorothy. I only see her every 3 years or something, but she was a fantastic editor, and yeah, so there's a connection.
So yeah, no, I mean, I think that, but then, you know, I became David's assistant after like a softball game. You know,
wait, and so in like the hierarchy of the New Yorker, David's assistant is a better gig than fact-checking?
No, well, I think in terms of like pay and stuff, it's below, but it sets you up for a different kind of path, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel incredibly lucky to have had that fact-checking experience. I mean, that was like a crash, the only kind of crash course I've gotten in reporting. That's something that my dad did not, now I refer to him for advice, but like the actual practical experience reporting, I didn't write for the Crimson. Like I didn't have a lot of reporting experience. And when you're a fact checker, you have to re-report a story at the New Yorker. So talking to sources and figuring out how to construct a story. And I mean, it's a really good lesson. And so I was really, really, that was totally valuable and grateful. And then working with David, I kind of learned how to, I mean, on the editorial side and how to construct a story and things like that. But
you learned about great editing by watching great editing.
Yeah.
One thing that struck me early in the game was Louise was an unbelievable editor. I mean, just way before her time, could take something that I wrote or her mom wrote and fix it. It was in a 360 editing. It wasn't just because it wasn't copy editing. It was conceptual. It was structural. It was the full deal. And some of that is because, you know, you're smart and you're good at it. But it must also be that you observed the incredible editing that happens at the New Yorker. Is that true?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I actually still have, I like kept copies of some of David's proofs. You know, I like have them. I mean, and I studied them, you know, and memos and stuff from like Henry Find or whatever. I like really studied, you know, what those look like.
And you learned.
And I'm probably, I think you actually might agree with me. I'm probably a better editor still than I am writer.
Oh, I think you're, no, I don't know about that, but you are, this got me, that when she was too young to be that good an editor. I've had some great editors, including Dorothy Wickenden. I've had some really great editors. But to be 25 and to be able to be so confident about seeing the problems with a story and saying, no, really, you got to do something major here, mm-hmm. not just a little polish, but there's a structural flaw deeply embedded in this, and say that when you're that young, made me go, holy smokes, where did that come from?
Confident enough to say that to your dad, too.
Right. She's, I think, always been pretty confident saying stuff to me. I don't think that's been a problem.
Yeah, I don't think that was the issue. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that was also funny, though, at that point, because that was one thing where, like, at that point, Dad would say, you know, like, this is really great. He's like, you would say I was a much better editor than I was writer, which was true. It is. You know, I mean, we can argue about whether it's.
I don't think it's true now, but I think maybe it was true when you were 24.
Yeah, I think it was true.
How old were you when she was 24?
I'm 30 years older, so I was 54.
You were still having like major structural holes in your stories when you were 54?
I still, yes. I'm 65. I have gaping, I have highways, wide structural holes.
I like to think that after the amount of experience that you have, that you just, like, you just nail it every time.
When I write a book, and I've written 9 of them, I write my introduction, I would say, 25 times.
I have. I'm going to step in to say I haven't read all of his books, but I have read parts of books where he's been having trouble and been able to.
Introductions especially. In fact, as a precocious, snotty little 13-year-old, you once stopped one of my, remember this?
Yeah.
I just remember, I'm bitterly remembering this. She tore up as like she was in ninth grade or something. So I happened to look at, condescend to read the first page of something and, so, and changed and said, the first sentence is all wrong.
It's true. He changed it too.
And I changed it and made it better. She was right, and I made it better.
So it wasn't really 25, it was more like 13.
Actually, in that case, yes.
That's amazing. All right, so there's a thing that I want to talk to you about, which is a thing that I read on the train today, this morning, on my way down, which is the first big Monica Lewinsky story. 1998.
Yeah.
It's quite a story.
Yeah.
Hell of a scoop.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't my scoop. It was Mike Isikoff's. I was the rewrite guy. My name is on that story with Mike, but you have to understand news magazines, which are very structured. The reporter was Mike Isikoff. He got that story. He dug it out over years. And I was wheeled in late in the game when we were about to break it to be the rewrite guy.
Right.
And he was content to do that because that's the way our system was. And I don't want to minimize my role because I had to work like hell to get that story in shape very quickly. I think that story is about 10,000 words the first week, which I wrote in about 36 hours.
Wow.
And I remember just crawling out of there. But it was his reporting. My job was to put it together and make it a narrative, to make it a story, and to make sure that it was just the obvious stuff, clear and fun to read. And I couldn't be like shooting fish in a barrel. How do you not make it fun to read? But well, I had to at least make it clear.
I think what he's going to point out is that it's like dated in certain ways.
You know, I'm going to point that out, but I'm going to get there.
Okay.
Well,
I'm still proud of it, but go ahead.
I think it would actually be interesting for our listeners who might not know how Time and Newsweek worked for years and years and no longer mm-hmm. work this way,
sure.
is that there were sort of teams of reporters,
mm-hmm.
Both in the main office, but also in bureaus all mm-hmm. over the world.
Yeah.
And then there were writers.
Yeah.
And the reporters would send their reporting to the writers.
Right.
And those guys, and they were almost all guys, yep. would put it together.
That's true.
And that was mostly what your role
yes,
was?
Yes, I was a kind of glorified writer. I'd been Washington bureau chief, and I can't remember what my title was. I think it was an assistant managing editor, but it doesn't matter. I was a glorified rewrite guy. And I took reporting from other people and spun it up and tried to make it coherent and make sense and fun to read and all that stuff. It was a kind of crazy, very expensive system. You couldn't duplicate it today. It was flawed because the tone and feel is being set by a writer in New York and Washington, not by the reporter in Vietnam or Moscow or Los Angeles. And that skewed the result.
How so?
Well, it made it really the mindset of a bunch of people had gone to Harvard and lived on the Upper East Side, and not whoever was often a younger person out in the field is really experiencing it firsthand. Mm-hmm. So it famously in Vietnam, the Time magazine would take the reporting from the field. The reporting from the field was, we're losing the Vietnam War. By the time it came out of the New York office, it was, we're winning the Vietnam War. That was the worst case. And they built in because of that. Built in various systems to guard against that, a system of comments and corrections. But really, in the end of the day, the power was in the home office and with the older, typically, you know, old white guys rewriting it. That would be me. And so that it could distort and skew. It was often polished and really well written and mm-hmm. tracked and was logical and even elegant sometimes, but kind of off, maybe 20 degrees off. I used to get stoned in law school and read news magazines for laughs because they had this kind of pompous tone, you know, this Olympian tone. And of course, a few years later, I was the guy doing it.
Did you ever get stoned to just read your own writing?
I didn't go. I just couldn't bear to do that.
All right, let's go back to Lewinsky. So you're the writer on that story. Isakov is the reporter. You know, as you're writing it in those 36 hours, this is
big,
huge.
Yeah.
You guys had the story. You held it for a week because they were investigating. Star was investigating Lewinsky and the Paula Jones thing and all this stuff. So you guys held it for a little bit. And in the interim, Matt Drudge put something up.
And the Washington Post.
And the Washington Post.
Yeah, but Drudge did first, then the Post on Drudge on Sunday or Saturday, Post on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. We come out the following Monday, but their new thing called the internet had just popped up, and we actually put something online. It was early days, late 90s. I wrote something very fast online after the Post broke the story. I put about 3,000 or 4,000 words online. I don't think anybody read it, but we did put it up. That was enough to get TV's attention.
So you, the Post, which was also owned by the same company that Newsweek was,
right,
came out underneath and scooped you?
Yep.
Bastards.
Yeah. Yeah. Damn it.
Isn't it all in the family?
Nah, we hate each other. sure, we're competitive. Absolutely. And they had a very good reporter who covered special prosecutor, and she got the story. You know, Drudge put it out there. She got the story and ran it. We raced to get something online. We did it about a day later. I can't remember how many thousand words, but just to get something out there. Then I went back to the keyboard to churn out a longer, fuller, deeper story. As we were doing that, though, we're going on TV. And I remember going to Larry King's Crossfire on CNN, and there was tremendous TV interest. So we were talking about the story. And the one thing that we had that nobody had was tapes, because Linda Tripp, Monica Lewinsky's alleged friend, had taped their conversations, and we had heard those tapes. So we were able to talk about them. The Washington Post didn't have those. We had that. So we went on TV and talked about it for a couple of nights while I was writing this story.
What did you think was going to happen? Like, what would have been your prediction for Clinton when you were writing that piece?
I wasn't sure. I thought there was a chance he'd go. I did. But within about 2 weeks, I personally had decided it wasn't bad enough to drive him from office.
Reading the story, I would have bet that you thought he was done.
I did for the first couple of weeks. Yeah. I think when I wrote that first. Yeah. I think my memory is we wrote three big stories in a row. I remember thinking by about week three that he was going to survive it and probably should survive it.
Well, it's just interesting. I mean, it felt like a time capsule. I mean, it was interesting to go back to this moment, especially, I mean, I don't know when this is going to run, but reading that story the morning after Hillary clinched the nomination was pretty jarring, because the tone of the piece is basically he's quite likely done.
Yeah, well, that's that stupid Olympian tone I was talking about earlier. And I may have felt it in that moment, but what I remember, of course, hindsight is always clear, is that after several weeks, three weeks, you know, he's going to survive this, and he probably should, because it's just not worth a constitutional crisis. Now, it dragged on for 9 more months because he was impeached,
right,
and there was a trial in the Senate, so, and there was the Star report. So it went on and on, and we dutifully covered it all. But my memory was that at the outset, it was super exciting, super scary. Oh, my God, what are we writing here? We better be right, or we're all going to be selling insurance, you know, next week. And that was giddy for the first couple of weeks. But then I remember thinking, you know, he's going to survive this and probably should.
One of the other themes that comes through it is the way that you guys wrote about Monica. The tone is also, in hindsight, feels like a time capsule and pretty wild. And I wondered whether it shaped the narrative at all. The last line of that first piece is like something, the last paragraph is something like, presidents have been felled by assassins and their own corruption, but never before has an American president been taken down by a girl who needed attention.
This is where his daughter disavows.
Oh no, I'm running for cover on this. I haven't heard those words for a long time. I'm like, I'm starting to sweat. The amnesia setting in. Oh my God, what did I write? Sorry, Monica.
It was like, wow. Yeah. That is a different impression than I currently have of her.
I confess, I'm blithering here. I mean, I don't even remember writing that. I'm speechless.
Well, I mean, part of the reason I ask is because of that like Olympian tone, it's hard for me. I mean, I was not as precocious as Louisa when I was 17 when that story came out. I was definitely not editing anyone's introductions to their books. And so I don't remember how much that those early stories shaped that narrative, but I wondered reading it again this morning whether how much that was on your mind. Like, you guys had the story, you had the tapes, and it's just interesting to think like whether you were thinking about that scope or not when you wrote those kinds of pieces.
What scope?
How you shape how people, not only the information that people have, but the kind of tone and attitude.
Oh, we wanted to shape the tone and attitude. That's why I'm cringing at this. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That was our goal. Often, remember, we're not really bringing... Now, in this case, we were bringing new information. Unusual. The old joke about a news magazine is like... A news magazine with a scoop is like a whore with a baby. They don't know what to do with it. Because it was unusual that we really had fresh reporting.
Coming through again.
In this case, we really had fresh, stuff. But more often, we were setting tone in what you ought to believe about it, not really presenting new information. We were taking information that was already out there and telling you, instructing you in a somewhat pedantic way, what to believe.
What was your relationship with the White House after that?
Terrible, I'm sure. I'm trying to remember. I just saw Mike McCurry last night, actually, the world's greatest press secretary. So I remember having good feelings that they had a good press secretary, but I'm sure that our relations were just horrible. We were out to get him. You know, it was an existential crisis for the White House. We were out to get him, and it was a nightmare. But as I say this, I don't think there really was much any contact with the White House because they certainly weren't speaking to us about this. Our contact was all, you know, it was really Mike's reporting, the kind of underworld of Monica Lewinsky and Linda Tripp and the special prosecutor's office. So those are the people we were talking to. We were trying to, we were writing about Vernon Jordan, who is the president's friend, and trying to find his role.
Part of the reason I was asking about the Clintons in particular is that I have wondered whether your work covering Lewinsky and covering the Clinton White House has interacted at all with the profile that you're doing, Louisa, of Bill. Like, do you...
We hope not.
Yeah.
Does he know?
No. Well, I don't... I mean, I have no idea. Because the campaign has been actually great, generally, about helping me get whatever information I need. But like all reporters so far, Clinton has not sat down for any interviews this year. So he has not sat down. I hope to change that by the time this runs, but I'm working under the expectation that I'm not going to. So I haven't talked to him, and so I have no idea. I mean, I know that he knows I'm doing the story and, you know, it's like pretty easily Googleable if someone wants to tell him. I've found that they're actually pretty professional. I actually think that everyone I've talked to is, I can't imagine that would matter, to be honest. I don't have a, like, it's pretty clear that I don't have a certain vendetta, and I think that's, no one has suspected me of that, so.
I mean, I'm open to the idea that it's not... anything.
I think it's not anything. I think that
but you can see how it's interesting to me, right? It's like whatever it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Like you were writing about Bill. Now his wife is on the verge of the White House and your daughter is writing about Bill. Like it says something about kind of the way the world works.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is something that I told my editor right away. You know, I said to my editor, you know, just I'm fascinated by this topic, this person, but like you should know that, you know, there's a small chance that the campaign would just not cooperate at all, because if they decide that, you know, I might have a certain kind of viewpoint because I'm, you know, daughter of Evan Thomas, that, you know, that I'm just putting that out there. But, you know, I didn't really expect any problems, and I have not run into any problems from that.
Can I talk to you guys about the books you write for a second?
By all means.
Yeah.
It seems to me like that is another point of connection between the work that you guys do. They are, many of them, concerned with the kind of interior lives of historical figures. Does that sound like,
yes,
an accurate description?
Definitely. Absolutely. It's what we care about the most by far.
Why? I mean, like, why is that where your family has settled in its book writing?
Well, that's a good question.
That is a good question.
I mean, I think it's where the action is. It's where the most, to me, it's the most interesting question. Get inside their heads. What are they really thinking? It's extraordinarily challenging, of course, because you can't really know. And writing about Nixon, at least there are tapes. With Louisa, she's got to go back centuries to write about Louisa Catherine Adams. But Louisa Catherine Adams wrote 3 memoirs, endless letters. So, you know, it was doable.
And not only that, like, she more than most historical figures. I mean, one of the reasons why she was such a great subject, even though she's not well known, is that she wrote so much about how she was feeling,
right,
and thinking. And obviously you have to,
like, a 3-volume autobiography.
Right. I mean, there's a, you have to contextualize all this, but she was pretty transparent, you know, and that was a gift. I mean, you can't do that with that many people.
And she feels modern.
Yeah.
It's like a modern voice because she's talking about her feelings in the early, you know, 1800s, most men were like her husband, uptight, writing for posterity,
right,
about
their future biographers.
Their future biographers, and inauthentic, very defended.
Mm-hmm.
She's writing in a more modern way, revealing emotion, revealing her inner thoughts, very authentic that way, very accessible.
Yeah.
Is that a way that you guys and your family talk about,
yes,
people in your lives?
Yes. Oh yeah. Sure.
I mean that is the short answer. I mean, these are the kinds of conversations we have at the dinner table, really, is,
yeah,
about my dad. I mean, we have points of disagreement. My dad has a tendency to refer to, quote, human nature, and he puts on his Olympian tone, talks about how people are. And I'm much more, you know, I'm much more...
More subtle, sophisticated, and nuanced.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I'm much more willing to point out, you know, various, you know, culture and circumstance, yes, and all sorts of... He's very kind of like old white man sometimes, and I'm very not.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the Louisa's criticism of me, which I took as sort of a compliment, is reductionist. Dad, you're being reductionist. Well, what the hell do you think I did at Time and Newspaper? 33
that
years.
That was the job.
Yeah. So I think, and that, I mean, that has been a good dialogue for us.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Really great.
Yeah.
For me. I've been enormously, I mean, Louisa does have, I'm kidding her about it, but she does have a subtle mind about human nature, as I so pompously put it. And that's just a wonderful, joyful dialogue.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's something that we talk about when we talk about stories and our books and things like that. And it's also something we talk about when we talk about whatever we're reading or people we know. Or,
and ourselves.
You know, and ourselves.
Well, that was kind of constantly. That was kind of what I was interested in. Like, it, whether, I mean, Louisa, you and I have had a conversation about this previously, about how there was something about her that you saw in yourself, and you felt like you learned something about yourself.
Yeah, something about Louisa. Yeah.
Yeah.
Catherine Adams, not Louisa.
Yeah, that is confusing. And I wonder whether you guys do that for each other, like whether you talk about your interior lives together and are helpful there, or whether it's more external than that.
Oh, no, definitely. We talk about our internal lives. Yeah,
we're neurotic together.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Neurotic apart and neurotic together.
I was actually telling Max, sort of revealing a lot on the long form podcast, but one thing that I really appreciate about my dad is that he sometimes writes things about like Monica Lewinsky that make me cringe, says things too sometimes that make
yeah.
But also is incredibly open to stepping back and, you know, talking through and reflecting and like, was that a really appropriate thing to say? Or, you know,
living with three women who are better at this than I am has been, and I've learned, you know, my wife OC edits me, and brilliantly, because she sees through my pomposity and questions it and my Olympian tone and deconstructs it and humanizes it. And that's enormously valuable. I mean, one thing I did learn in defense of news magazines, editing is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. You want to be edited. And I have a great need for and respect for great editors, including my 13-year-old daughter. That's true. And Louise has always been good about being edited. In fact,
and
a little bit too
I
good.
You
kind of rewrite too much sometimes, I think. But that's an important... A lot of people don't like to be edited.
Yeah. And that is something I've definitely learned from Dad, is the appreciation of editing and being edited. And openness... Also to the idea that your editor is not always right in the content of what they're saying. They might not have the right fix.
Right.
But if they've identified a problem, it's probably a problem.
Right.
You know, they might not know how to fix it, but as long as you kind of actually approach, not be defensive about the idea that you've done it right, and then, you know, really kind of work through. You might come up with something different, but they've probably identified a real problem.
Yeah. And you have to, I'm completely defensive. You know, when my work is criticized by my wife or by Louise or anybody else, my first instinct is to deny it.
Yes.
But I've, from many, many years of experience, you know, have learned to calm down and you know, listen. Because as Louise says, they may not have the right fix, they may not have the right criticism, but if they got a problem, there is a problem. Mm-hmm. Because you're writing for other people.
Right.
So if other people have a problem, you have a problem.
Does OC read things first?
Sure. And last and in between, and reads all sorts, you know, there are many, many stages. It's a very iterative process. Writing a book is extremely iterative. I didn't show her magazine articles, I don't think, because those are on deadline. And
She's a lawyer.
She was raising a family. She was a lawyer. She didn't have time. But now she sure does.
But also, I would also say that it is valuable for me. Sometimes I'm a little bit too defensive about being reductionist. You know, I'm like, well, there are all these mitigatives. circumstances, and I don't want to sound this way, and I don't want to, you know, not give them credit for this, and I don't want to, you know, and sometimes you do, you know, if you're writing like a couple thousand words about something, you really do have to have a point and, you know, drive to it, and that is something that, you know.
The billboard paragraph.
You know,
often the last thing you write is what's this piece actually about? You don't know until you've written the piece. But you do have to kind of give the reader some directional signals. I mean, not always. There's a New Yorker historically, maybe not now, but, you know, it was like a wandering through a beautiful garden and you're not quite sure where you were going, but, you know, you're going to get someplace. News magazine discipline was billboard paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
You know, arrows to Toyland, as we used to say. You know, this is where this is going. You know, directional signals.
Why should I care?
Why should I care?
Yeah.
Right. The famous expression was the paragraph that says, why am I invited to this party?
It sounds to me like the way that you guys think about each other and talk to each other is on a very level playing field. It's not hierarchical in the way that your news magazines were.
Well, not as hierarchical as I wish it was sometimes, or could be.
You wish you could go back and assert your parental role. It was taken from you at 13.
No, I mean, I love being on an even playing field. It's more fun and rich, and I was, you know, I guess as I think about it, I have not thought about this much, but I should think about this because I was fearful of my father, and I'm sure I'm trying to correct against that, of not being the omniscient Jehovah figure. I just don't want to be that, and so I think I've tried not to be. Now, it's complicated because, as Louise has already said, I could pronounce and sound like I was, you know, handing down tablets from on high. But I hope I have learned to stop that, or at least after I do it, to pause and say, well, you know, Richard Nixon used to say, this decision is final, unless you disagree. That's probably the way I am.
What have you learned from Louisa?
Oh, all sorts of things. To be more open and thoughtful, and you know, there are big generational things here. I taught for 7 years, so it's not just for my kids; it's also for my students. I taught at Harvard and Princeton, and that was an eye opener. I mean, the generations are different. I had narrow views about this and that, and they needed to be broadened. Just, there's no particular generalization, but just being around kids, or not kids, they're, you know, young adults, just being around them when they come from very different worlds, mm-hmm. Was helpful and kind of eye-opening to me and humbling.
That's one thing I've learned from my dad, though. I mean, to appreciate that, they're the kind of capacity to be open to becoming more open, you know, to learn from other people's experiences. I mean, that's like a pretty basic thing if you're going to be a writer, you know, is to want to learn from other people's experiences. Otherwise, why am I invited to this party?
And it's hard. I don't pretend to succeed at this. I mean, sometimes I do, but I do miss the boat. Mm-hmm. I had students, what the hell are you talking about? For 12 weeks, I never got it. But with others, I did.
Has that instinct of yours, that sort of curiosity and openness, has that ebbed at all?
I think it's grown.
I hope it's grown. I hope so. I was not the most open-minded young person. I've had to work at it.
How do you do that work?
You know, just the same way anybody does, by having children, by having a family, by having smart women around me, by teaching, you know, by reading, I don't have anything remarkable to say about this, all the obvious stuff.
You, Louisa, were a little nervous about this. Like, you expressed to me many times that you were a little nervous about this. And that, and it's interesting to me the way that you're talking about your dad and sort of openness and sort of a willingness to put something out there and see if it's wrong. Like, I'm just trying to like draw the line between those two things, if there is a line to draw.
Well, I mean, I'm one of the like contradictions inherent in me is that I'm someone who I'm like incredibly open. Like, I just say things, but I'm also incredibly private. So I often regret having said things, or I'm get nervous about saying things, and you know,
you got that from me. I'm a blurter, but then I regret it.
But then you regret it.
Yeah.
So you never kind of know where things are going to
So you're just mostly like wariness of your own blurting.
Yeah. Oh, not in this case. I'm worried about my own blurting and my dad's blurting.
Do you think you'll ever write about yourself?
I don't like writing about myself. On the other hand, I'm always writing about myself. You know, if I'm writing about like a tennis player, like I'm probably kind of secretly writing about myself in some way. You know, in some ways, like it's the only subject I have, you know, at the end of the day. And it's kind of interesting because when I started writing about sports, I really did not know about sports at all. Like, I probably knew less than the casual fan sometimes. But, you know, I know myself, you know, and I know how to ask kind of questions, not just of people, but, you know, of the experience of watching or, you know, whatever. But the sort of way into anything is kind of like Carl Bialik, the writer at 538, once called this the Thomas Doctrine. He's always kind of like secretly writing about yourself. Maybe that's very kind of like deceptive, and I would get in trouble for.
Well, there's a cliche. That, all biography is autobiography.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true and kind of has to be.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, you're sort of changed by your subject as well. So it's not like a one-way street. You're just sort of like projecting onto your subject. You have to be, again, like the flip side of this is I feel the reason I love doing this is that I want to know about other people's experiences. I don't want my experience to be the limiting factor in my life. You know, like the whole point about interacting with other people is to be open and learn about that. And
do you think that you, the returns on that kind of investment are exponential or reducing when you stay in the same general field. Like if you stick with sports, do you think that you'll go deeper and learn more in that way, or that it'll start diminishing at some point? And I ask that in part because a lot of your books have sort of centered around the same general themes.
Well, I don't stick with any one thing, so I hope the answer is no. I mean, it helps. Like, I have an expertise problem, probably. Like, I should probably bear down a little bit harder on something. And obviously, if I write my next book about the early Republic, it will probably be better for it because I don't have to, like, give myself a PhD in history, you know, again.
Do you wish you had turned Louisa into a musical?
Absolutely. If anyone wants to, by the way, like, completely, like, rights are available. Like, by all means. You know, I do think that I could probably use some more, you know, deep diving. The thing about sports that I love is that they're, you know, you're never, I mean, this is the other cliche, you're never writing about sports. I mean, I don't do, like, game stories, you know, feed recaps. So they're inexhaustible. I mean, basically sports are like a, you know, a high pressure situation. We put people in high pressure situations and pit them against each other and then see what happens. You know, I mean, that's like life.
You know? Well, that's why one reason I like writing about war, just put people in under unbelievable stress and see what happens.
And so I don't think that that ever gets tired, you know? I don't think that ever grows old. And I tend to be drawn to stories that are more kind of humanistic, less kind of... I mean, I wish in some ways. Some days I wish I were like Zach Lowe and I could just break down a play like it was nothing. But at the end of the day, I'm sort of more interested in heads.
I think of doing a hour plus long interview with one of my parents as like being under unbelievable stress. So I hope this was not painful for you guys. I also don't know when you'll be in the situation again. So if there's anything else that you think we should talk about, you should tell me. When are you going to be in your childhood bedroom again? Are we in your childhood bedroom right now?
No, we're in my parents. Even better, we're in my parents' bedroom when I was a child.
Okay, so we're in your parents' old bedroom. You're sitting here with your dad with microphones and some random person you decided to let into your house. Is there anything else that you think we should talk about?
That'll shut you right up.
Thank you guys for doing this.
Thank you.
Fun.
Thanks for listening to this special Father's Day edition of the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. The show is edited by Henry Malofsky. Our intern is Courtney Harrell. Thanks very much to MailChimp for their continued support of this show. They are why we can do pop-up things like this, and they themselves are doing a pop-up thing. It's a store. It's called Freddie & Co. It's at freddieand.co. Go check it out. They've got some fantastic stuff in there, and they're running a little special. You get free shipping coming up on June 28th. Thanks most of all to Evan and Louisa Thomas. That was a real kick for me. Happy Father's Day to all of you. We'll be back next week on Wednesday. See you then.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running. But they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast-closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.